I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Have you ever wished that you didn't have to go and fetch that tennis ball again? Have you ever wondered how deaf people might be alerted to the squeal of a smoke detector? Well, you'd think that the technical and mechanical answers to questions and challenges like that would come from a place like MIT, and you wouldn't be completely off the mark. But skip past the PhDs. This week, it is high school inventors who are roaming the campus. 13 teams of students, whiz kids from across the country, are at MIT, all recipients of the annual Lemelson MIT Invent Team Grants. Now, they've come with their fuel cells and their wind-powered water pumps, and we have two team representatives here with us in the Connection studio. We also have one of MIT's top students, an expert in robotics and artificial intelligence. You are invited to join us in a conversation about inventing. Can you teach it? Or do you have to be born with the mind and the curiosity of geeks like Mr. Peabody and Sherman in order to build something like the Wayback Machine? How do you inspire kids today to grab some glue and wire and electrodes and make something? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'll introduce the guests who will be with us for the hour. James McGlurkin is a PhD candidate in computer science already at MIT and already the inventor of robotic ants and swarm bots. He teaches both high school and college students. And you took a little umbrage earlier when I said you'll be our wise man for this show.
Yeah, I'm not used to exercising my gray hair like that.
All right, but it's good to have you here, James. Genevieve Garris is here. She is a senior at Gulf Coast High School in Naples, Florida. We'll be talking about the invention from Florida in just a moment. But Genevieve, thank you for coming in.
It's wonderful to be here.
And Andrew Esther is a junior at West Salem High School in Salem, Oregon. And Andrew, let's find out what it is that you have brought to the table. First of all, welcome and congratulations to both of you and you know, to your teams as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. What did you guys bring? What's your invention, Andrew?
Well, what we brought to Boston here was a watermelon thumper. Basically,
like a hammer or something.
Yeah, yeah. It just has a little arm. It swings out and thumps your melon and tells you if it's ripe.
You've got it there. Now, it's not hooked up to all its electronics to work properly at this point?
No. There's nothing fancy about this one. It's just the louder the thump, the brighter the lights are. That's basically all this one does right now. Our good ones over at the showcase.
Now, I've been in the grocery store and seen people thumping everything from cantaloupes to watermelons, and nobody ever seemed to know exactly what it was they were listening for. Have you figured that out?
Yeah, we've kind of figured that out. That's one of the really big challenges we ran into is no matter how many people we asked or how many people we interviewed, we couldn't really get a definite answer of what do you listen for when you thump a watermelon. It was always just, oh, well, it kind of just sounds ripe. So that's one of the really big challenges we ran into.
Where did the idea for the invention come from?
It came from one of our teammates, Ryan Boniker. He used to work at Safeway in the produce department. He'd always get people coming up to him and asking him to pick them out a ripe watermelon. And he kind of just got the idea one day to sit down and draw up some sketches of a device that might do that for him. So,
does it work?
Yes. At this point in time, it does work.
Are we going to see this at the farmer's market? You know, I'm going to take it over to the watermelon tester to make sure? Or what are you thinking?
Well, our initial idea was that we were going to release it to consumers and produce marketers, so people that would take the produce from the commercial grower and would sell it to consumers so that you could use it on a consumer level. But the more we thought about it, the more we realized that if we released it on a commercial grower level, in other words, if they could test the watermelons before they even ship them, there really would be no need for this to be on the consumer level. And
little color-coded stickers on the melons. This has been tested. It
yeah.
is one day away from
yeah,
ripe,
yeah.
right?
You know, like you get on your pants, tested by 20.
Yeah. I always wondered who
there you go.
20 was. Genevieve, let's talk about the electrostatic air purifying fan, which is not with us in the studio, though on this day it should be. It's a nice warm day. Where did the idea for an air cleaning fan come from?
That's actually a very funny story. It was an experience that I have. I'm the designated cleaner of the ceiling fans in my house. I live in Southwest Florida, so we always have the ceiling fans on and they get dirty very quickly. So one day, after being bombarded by infomercials about ionic breezes and other air cleaning systems, I was on a stool and cleaning my fan with a Swiffer, and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I, you know, could somehow connect these two technologies, if I didn't have to clean it, or if we could clean the air so this could kind of be skipped. And just sort of through the process of thinking about it, we made the connection, or I made the connection, and we came up with this electrostatic air purifying fan, and pretty much it utilizes the technology that's already on the market, in ionic breezes, an electrostatic plate, an ionizing wire, and it's hooked up actually to a ceiling fan. The plate is on the ceiling fan blade. The ionizing wire is on the leading edge, so as air passes past the...
Go ahead, I'm following.
Flows past. I'm sorry, it's very technical.
No, I'm liking this. Go on.
Yes, but as air flows past the ionizing wire on the leading edge of the blade, particulates in the air are pretty much charged and are attracted to a copper plate, which is on the ceiling fan blade. So
what do you do then? Take the plate off and wash it, or just have to wipe the plate? Is that all involved?
All you have to do is just simply either wipe the blade clean, and in the future... we would actually unhinge the blades so you can simply take them down and wipe them off. Or we have a second prototype, which is really interesting, which is off the blade, which actually it's a square configuration of, as it stands now, of PVC pipe. But it's the same exact technology, a curved plate and ionizing wire, and it hangs right below the ceiling fan blade, or right below the ceiling fan on the center console. So you'd simply, if you wanted to clean it, you just pull it down off the center console, wipe it clean, and put it back up.
Does it work?
It does, and it's very exciting that it does.
I want to ask you both one thing about where the ideas not only come from, because we've got that now, but where they get water. Do the teachers play a key role in this in either of your cases?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Is there someone in particular who went, yeah, do this, or a teacher who got you interested in the idea of solving problems?
Oh, yes, absolutely. My science teacher of 2 years in high school, Mrs. Copeland, she teaches AP Physics and AP Chemistry, and she really was really passionate about science and passionate about really motivating students to get interested in, you know, pursuing knowledge, you know, doing something that would really make a difference, be really beneficial in the future. And she really was, she sort of had an informational meeting about...
Watch that little cable there. When you bang on that, it makes a noise. That's okay.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's all right.
About Lemelson MIT Invent Teams program. She really was very excited about the program and really motivated us as a whole for our team to continue with the project and to do something that would make a difference.
Could you have done it without her, do you think?
Probably not with the fervor. She really, as we got bogged down toward the end with problems, she was really like, you know, you can do it, guys, just to keep going.
What about it, Andrew? Was there someone who was really instrumental in keeping your team on track here?
There sure was. My science teacher, Michael Lamper, who is also our adult team leader, I'm a junior, and I've had him since freshman year, and he has been a great inspiration. He's always doing stuff for the kids. He practically lives at school. There's a joke going around school that Lampert lives there, and one of his students actually wrote a song that basically described his life at school. And he is always doing after-school things, always trying to get students involved. West Salem High School is actually brand new. I don't know if you know that or not. It's been around for 3 years. So I've been going there all 3 years it's been around, and Michael Lampert actually got us involved our first year in the first robotics competition. And he's always leading teams like that. He's always trying to get students outside of the classroom engaged in education that's not just stuff that they're required to learn by the school. I don't think our team would have made it without him. He's the one who came to us and said, hey, you know, I know that you guys can do this. I've seen your class. You know, I've seen you outside of school. You guys should really get together and try this and give it a go and see what you get out of it. I don't think our team would have made it at all without him. He kept us going, and he was there until 11:30 midnight with us working on stuff. And he was...
I'm wondering, James McLurkin, as you're listening to these two high school students talk about the importance of the teacher, if this comes as any surprise to you, or if you have the same kind of memories.
Professor Eugene Warasella. He was a biology instructor, and he couldn't help me much with designing and developing robots. But there's a program called Science Research Skills. There's a period set aside to work on independent science projects. And the validation of knowing that this is useful, this is good, this is wonderful, and the knowledge of science contents in the area and participation in events like that, very important to get that kind of validation early on.
See, the funny thing is that I've read lots of news stories about your work. You're being courted by the Pentagon and other people for the robotic work that you do. And when they go back into James McLurkin as a young student, you were a troublemaker. You weren't a good student, right?
I'm not the best student, no. No, not among my best qualities.
The reason I'm asking is I'm trying to figure out how much school matters, because that's where I want our callers to join us on the program here. I mean, is it an essential part of like watering the ideas? We know that we've all got ideas, but is the school an important part of that?
So there's the formal school, then there's the community of invention and building, and the people who you work with. There's the shop instructor, your senior college classmates. Parents, people who've been here before, the bicycle store repair guy.
Seriously, for parts?
Yeah. For parts, for ideas, for knowledge of a welder nearby. So I was trying to build a multiple speed system for my bikes many years ago, and I needed to weld some stuff to my bicycle. And what do I know about welding? I'm a high school kid.
So you basically search out your support network wherever it is, but school is an important part of that.
It's critical.
I want to just remind our listeners that in this program, we're talking with Andrew Ester and Genevieve Garris, James McGlurkin, all three of them inventors. We're going to talk a little bit more about their own inventing and their own inspiration. But we'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Does school matter? Does the teaching part of this matter? Is this a part of the equation where, you know, people are always complaining about the U.S. is falling behind in science and engineering, and is this evidence that maybe it's not? We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. And that noise is not, in fact, coming from a recorded disc, but two very small robots that are sitting on the table between the four of us here. James, maybe you can tell us a little bit. What are these guys called?
These are swarm bots.
Swarm bots.
They were built at our robot as part of a government contract to study software for distributed robot swarms.
Can we hear him over the... Yeah, we're fine. Go ahead.
Okay. So the goal was to... write software for large numbers of robots. The government's very interested.
Can I pick one of these guys up?
Sure, sure. I think they're girls, actually. It's hard to tell, though.
Okay, I'll be gentle then.
Well, they've got skirts. So
they're what, like 5 inches by 5 inches, right?
Yeah, they're 5 inches square, and they're surrounded by bump skirts on all sides, so they know when they're running into things. And they've got lights on the top, so we can tell, for example, right now, we're hearing the Emperor's March very clearly in audio and also visual on the lights. So the lights are very important for debugging, so we can know what the robots are doing. Because with 100 robots, these are two of 100, with 100 robots, you cannot debug them remotely. You have to be able to see what they're doing and get a feel for them as a whole unit. So the lights and the sounds are what the humans use to interact with the robots primarily.
Can we turn these guys off?
Sure. Hit the small square button in front of the blue light.
You go for it there, Andrew.
There you go.
I'm not going to touch that thing. I'll break it for sure.
No, you got it. It's fine. Andrew, if you want, inside this thing here, there's a secret hidden button in the other side. Push that in.
And you get an espresso at the other side.
There you go.
Oh, sweet.
Thank you.
These are 2 of 100.
2 of 100.
What do swarm bots do that one robot doesn't do? What's the idea of having swarm bots?
There are lots of applications for groups of robots. So for almost any task that robots are good for, tasks that are dangerous, dirty, and dull, groups of robots can do those tasks better. So the classic example is one of my favorite examples actually is exploring Mars. So right now we have 2 robots on Mars.
Right.
What if we had 2,000? Mars is a big planet. 2 robots can't cover all of it, at least not very quickly. So being able to cover a large area with large numbers of robots could really speed up the process of finding fossils or terraforming or looking for Martians or what have you. The problem, though, is that when they're that far away, they have to be able to control themselves, that you can't control them directly from Earth. So they need to be able to communicate, cooperate, and coordinate their actions so that their efforts are useful.
One thing for if anybody's listening online, you can go to our webcam and you can see these swarm bots on the table between the four of us. The question that I had about them is these two, are you saying that they talk to each other?
The robots use infrared to talk to each other, much the same way your remote control talks to your television, except a little more sophistication. They can also determine where their neighbors are. So the system works with a range of about 2 meters. Usually I have it tuned down to about a meter for a close-in work.
I want to ask both Genevieve and Andrew, when you look at the kind of thing that James is working on now, is that where you want to be in 5 or 10 years, or was the fan and the watermelon ripeness tester a sort of, you know, one-off science project gone crazy? What do you think?
I'd love to continue inventing in the future. It was really rewarding, and I would love to get to this level where it's something that is now on Mars. I mean, what an honor. And really, I really feel that that's really giving to the scientific community and really one person making an immense difference. So I'd love to continue this in the future.
I'd really like to be part of the teams that are doing these amazing things. I mean, you see stuff on TV. I think I saw these on PBS a while ago.
Yeah, yeah.
They're just amazing little things. And now to get to meet you, James, as you're... It's just amazing. I really like where technology is going now. I mean, you're getting smaller and you're getting more sophisticated, and I would love to continue not so much inventing, I think, but to be right on the cutting edge of technology, working with people who are inventing things to kind of integrate the new technology that's being invented with the technology that's still there.
And James, I know you do a special sort of Saturday morning session with minority high school students at MIT.
Yes.
Do you hear
yeah.
that same kind of enthusiasm when you're with those students as well?
So at the SEED program, the enthusiasm is always there. They're very excited. They're cut from a larger cross-section of the population. So these two here are serious inventors. These are people who are going to go on the technical lives most likely and going to do things like that. But the excitement and the fun and the passion and the joy of setting a project in front of somebody, and they get to it, they get their hands on it, they work through it, they can understand it, they can look at it from different angles, they can pick it up, they can drop it if they're not careful.
Does it have to be fun? Is that a big part of it?
Why spend your life doing something if it's not fun?
That's a very good point. I don't see why anything has to be over serious. I mean, look at our thing, a watermelon thumper. I mean,
I dig it. I think that's a great idea.
I mean, look at this thing. It just... It has a serious application,
yeah.
But it's not a very serious looking thing.
It's the idea behind it, isn't
yeah.
that what it's all?
Yeah, it
Can
is.
You just tell our people what's written on your shirt there? I forgot to
oh,
mention that.
Yeah, our bright pink shirts. Everybody was commenting on them yesterday at our show, and we're all wearing them today at the showcase at Stata. And I don't really know why we chose pink. We kind of just all liked pink.
Isn't it kind of a watermelon color?
It's pretty close.
I'd say more of a red color. I don't know.
It's a wonderful
color.
But
we definitely stand out. It's just got the Lemelson MIT Invent Team logo on it, and then it has our motto, Rind Over Matter.
Brilliant. I love it. Rind Over Matter. 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take a call from Norfolk, Virginia. Chris is on the line. Hey, Chris.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking... I was actually listening to your callers as students, and... I think there are three aspects to invention,
yeah.
Especially for making new inventors. First and foremost, there's always got to be a need. There has to be something that needs to be invented. Second, it takes a certain creativity. It takes a dreamer. And that's why, you know, kids are great to tap. If you can get into that inventive spirit in children and get them thinking about things, they come up with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then
when you
the
say kids, Chris, how young are you talking about? What do you think?
I'm thinking as early as 8, 7,
yeah.
6.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, they're always coming up with little gadgets, something they'd like to do, and maybe it's later before something reasonable comes out. But the third aspect is the adult, the mentor that can bridge the gap between the idea and the reality of showing them how to make it, or showing them how to weld something, or to encourage them and say, yes, this can be done. And then that can be a teacher, that can be, you know, especially somebody in a shop. I was a physics major. I had a metal shop at my disposal, and I love playing and making stuff, and it's that tinkering and inventive spirit. And once you get that as a kid, then you can continue on a lot more as an adult.
It's a great point, Chris. I wanted to just go around the table in terms of what kind of environment parents set up for kids. James?
The call is right on point there. There's for creativity, you have to foster a no squashing factor. You have to, in your group, with no squashing of ideas.
Right.
All ideas are valid. All ideas are on the table. Everything is good. For a parent, my view of the parent of a vendor is you're a good COO, a chief operations officer. It's your job to be a logistics manager. It's your job to know where the resources are, to be able to drive your youngster around, to get to the Radio Shack, to get to electronic stores, to get to the good libraries, yeah, to know things out there. It's your job.
Are you driving the kid to do this? Is it, or just sort of waiting for that little seed to sprout on its own?
I don't think you can make somebody want to invent something. I think it's got to be a desire that the person has.
Right. I mean, you certainly. I don't know any way to encourage somebody to go do think about something. They're going to wake up. They're going to have some desire to do something. They're going to be cleaning the fan. The idea is going to strike them, and it's your job then to recognize that it's there, and then to make sure that any obstacle that is in its way that you, as your parent, can remove from them.
Mm-hmm. Genevieve, was there a parent that one of your parents that was kind of behind this? You as a youngster, breaking stuff or putting stuff together?
Well, actually, my father is always coming up with silly inventions. For example, squeezable jelly, squeezable peanut butter was a silly idea my dad says he had years ago, and now it's on the market, and he's very upset with himself not patenting the idea. But overall, my parents have been very supportive of any new ideas and really emphasizing the fact that you can make a difference, and if you really want something, there's nothing in your way.
Mm-hmm. I'd have to say that my parents were a huge influence on me when I was a kid. They always had me with them. My parents wore me on a front pack, and whenever they were cooking, I was up on the counter, and they'd give me something to stir. Or my dad, we actually have two airplanes. We live on an airport in Salem, and my dad was restoring an airplane when I was a kid, and I'd always be down there in his shop helping him with something. And it's just the little things, like handing me a wrench so that I can play around with it and see if I can tighten or loosen a bolt here or there. It's just the little things, I think, that make the biggest difference. Just the environment that's there, that's put there in order to foster this and
can we say the Legos word? Is that a part of everybody's own?
Actually,
did you play
it is.
With Legos?
I played with Legos. I have a huge, one of those big old Tupperware boxes, probably two or three or four of those, just completely chock full of Legos. And U.S. First, they have First Lego Robotics League for the little kids. And I think in response to the caller saying that the younger kids have the opportunity to invent things, First has an excellent program for that. I mean, we've got kids as young as really early middle school, like 6th, 7th grade, inventing these Lego robots to overcome obstacles that, seem really tough for these 6th and 7th graders, but when you watch them all go perform and watch all their robots roll out and do these tasks that they've all programmed and built these robots to do, it's amazing what these kids come up
Genevieve,
with.
Genevieve, James, Legos, is that a part of...
Actually, I was more into Barbie dolls and whatnot, but I did also have the enormous Legos, and I did enjoy building, but in reference to children who are in elementary school or people who you wouldn't really respect the fact that they would be able to have an inventive spirit or be able to do something with their inventive motivation, my brother, Robert, who is now just going into the 8th grade, is very inventive, and as you were saying about the chock full of Legos, absolutely. Like, when he gets a package at Legos, go to a local store or whatever and buy a thing of Legos, he'll actually not follow the instructions and create something completely different.
I'm on national radio. I might as well confess. I just ordered the box set of the Star Wars Episode 3 Legos last night.
I knew it. I knew it.
What are you going to get with that? Do you get an engine? Is it flashing lights? I don't know what.
So the Lego that I'm ordering is just decorations for the shelves and the mantle. But the real magic of Lego is the beauty and the amazing engineering of the gears and the mechanisms and the electronic controllers now that they have with them. You can sit down and build very complicated mechanical devices. I've got a Lego car at home that has a 6-speed transmission with reverse and synchros, 4-wheel independent suspension, 4-wheel drive, and just really clear mechanical things.
Go ahead.
Oh, I think going back to, I don't know who said, I think maybe it's Genevieve, and playing off what you said earlier about the parents' role as being the kind of director and leader. Also, I think parents need to recognize their role more as a focuser and take all this creative energy that these kids have that sometimes comes out as destructive energy or that and kind of focus that down as they see the opportunities that their kids may have to
just like the,
to realize their interest in
description
in
you
things.
Had of a sort of working together, the like getting you up on the counter, having you engaged. Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, in a really elemental way, that's exactly what you're talking about. I want to go back to our callers, to Providence, Rhode Island. Paul's on the line. Hey, Paul.
Hi. I'd just like to point out that there's a kind of a strong class basis to a lot of this this research. The first robotics teams generally come from kind of upper middle class high schools. Middle class and working class schools have mostly eliminated their shop and art programs, at least at the middle school level. Providence Schools here, where my own son goes to school, is $30 million in debt, and no one seems to care. But their shop classes got turned into technology education, which mostly eliminated the kind of hands-on stuff for pretty dry computer-based instruction.
Genevieve's nodding as you're describing that, Paul. Is this what you're seeing in Naples as well, Genevieve?
Correct. There is no, I understand at one time there was a shop class, but we are experiencing, I understand in Florida in general, there are no shop classes. It's now all, you know, computer programming, mm-hmm. computer technology. So I completely understand what you're going through.
But does that strangle the opportunity to invent that we're talking about in a way?
Perhaps it could constrict a little bit, because I think that's really one of the funner parts maybe for some people about inventing is like the hands-on, taking things apart, putting things together, seeing an immediate product. But I think if someone is really interested in inventing, they can still pursue it in another way through computer.
I think that the shop aspect of it is extremely critical, especially at a young age, because when you're younger, the things that foster and that create the want and need to invent later are physical, like Legos or like, you know, the Barbies even, or like me being up on the it's all about doing things with your hands and getting involved. And then as you move on and you get older, then it starts to become more of the computer programming aspect, or okay, well, I can build this, but instead of using all these circuits to make it go forward then turn right, how can I program it, or how can I use computers?
Let me just go back to Paul here on the line from Providence and ask Paul, will the students themselves find replacements for lost shops, that sort of thing? Is that your experience or no?
The upper class, the middle class students that have outside support systems will find those things. I teach robotics at an art school, at Rhode Island School of Design,
yeah.
So can provide some of those opportunities. But the shop class, I just think, is crucial. And there was an educational philosopher, John Dewey, around the turn of the century, that emphasized kind of primary learning with basic materials like clay and wood. And all this seems to have been thrown overboard in the last 20, 30 years.
James, you get this great mix of students in your Saturday
right.
program, right?
So there's a huge, I mean, my whole opinion, I think the best place for the shop is at home. Almost everybody has the financial resources and the resources around them to go get themselves a power drill, saw, some screwdrivers, and to start. And there's a lot you can build and fabricate in the comfort of your basement.
Does some of that inspiration have to come from a school, or does it help?
But the caller's right. You can see a real difference with kids coming from schools where they've had shops, where they have access to a bandsaw, a drill press, things that are big, heavy equipment,
yeah.
And students that really don't have a good feel for even how to use a screwdriver sometimes. And you look at these students, you see this great potential. There's no lack of intelligence, there's no lack of intellect, there's no lack of creativity, but they haven't had the hands-on skills to get things built.
When we talk about the inventing, though, Genevieve, does it qualify to talk about the kind of inventing that happens right at a keyboard when you're doing your own programming as well? I mean, that's a part of it, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. I think it would be a part of it. But I absolutely agree that the physical hands-on, but I think also something that maybe the physical hands-on is more of a crucial role is that those tools and something like that can be rather intimidating to someone. We're now living in this age of technology where a computer may not be as intimidating. It may be an easier piece of software to access first. And maybe with that, you know, enthusiasm you may get out of initially using a computer, then you can move on to screwdrivers and such.
All right, 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us this hour. Can you teach invention, and are we looking at a high school system in this country that is drifting away from that as shops are closed and art classes are squeezed out in the interest of going with basic 3 R's education? Our telephone number, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Genevieve Garris. She is a senior at Gulf Coast High School in Naples, Florida. In one of the members of a team from that school that invented an electrostatic air purifying fan. Andrew Esther is also with me. He's a junior at West Salem High School in Salem, Oregon, and part of the team that put together a watermelon ripeness evaluator. There two teams were among the 13 that won grants from the Lemelson MIT Invent Teams annual competition. James McGlurkin is also with us, along with two of his swarm bots in the studio. He's a PhD candidate in computer science at MIT and also working at the Computer Science Artificial Intelligence Lab. But you don't need a whole lot of intelligence to find our phone number. We're at 1-800-423-TALK 2 Boston. Ellie's on the line. Hi, Ellie.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I teach some, I'm coming from an artist perspective, I teach some very disciplined, intelligent, hardworking, studious ballet dancers. And we've been working on composition, which is an invention. And I find that in some ways school is, I think, a hindrance for these kids because they're so consumed with doing what's right and following the rules and doing what they need to do to get the right grade. And
but Ellie, isn't ballet part of that as well? I mean, it's such a rigorous thing. You've got to do it just this way. There's no room for freelancing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And so I do modern and composition with them, and it's, you know, the suspension of rules that's required for invention and the playfulness. I think the young woman was talking about her sister who likes to build Legos without using the instructions.
Yeah.
That spirit of inventiveness is, I think, really hard for kids who are in really academic and studious situations.
Let me ask James about this, because he's been rubbing shoulders with inventors of a number of different ages for a period of years. Is there a spirit of I don't know, the rebel in that runs through inventors, people who don't like to look at the instructions?
Yeah, we all like to think of ourselves as these audacious, daring members of society out somewhere doing daring things with screwdrivers. The desire to create is tied to the desire to not conform a little bit.
Yeah.
Why do something that just like something that has already been done? You have to want to get out into some free ground and to get out into open area. Your caller being an artist actually is interesting. The difference between a really exceptional engineer and an artist, when it comes down to it, boils down to a bunch of math. They're both solving problems. They both have to work in the physical world. They both have constraints they need to work with. They have to take this material and move it to something, a finished product, physically, and understand how that works. And engineers have specifications and sheets. Artists have a message and things like that.
But there's art in all of this. Ellie, do you buy that?
Yeah. I think that's definitely. Well, I think as far as process is concerned, it's true that the difference is in the product. But in terms of process, I think, you know, art and science are really linked that way. And just in terms of what he was saying about being the rebel, that's something I'm trying to instill in these kids. It's important to follow the rules. It's good to follow the rules, but you'll never make a breakthrough following, you know, you might never really create or invent or make a phenomenal discovery.
I want to take this conversation back to the school cafeteria and the way that it breaks down in high school today. Are there the science kids at this table and the artist kids at this table? Are there geeks over here and jocks over here? Does it still break down that way? Are you finding that their lines are changing a little bit, eh? Andrew?
Well, I don't know. West Salem High School is a really interesting school in that kind of system of breakdown, class separation,
clique, the whole thing.
I think that it's getting to the point where the lines are starting to blend. It's still not perfectly, you know, everyone's getting along with everyone or everyone sits with everyone else, but it's starting to get there. It's starting to blend. I know that everybody on our team, our invent team, we're not all geeks and we're not all, you know, jocks and we're not all preps or whatever, but we all kind of come from a little bit different place in the social structure. Myself, I'm a musician, so I kind of come from there, but I also enjoy doing computer stuff and mechanical engineering, whereas some of the other people on the team, they really enjoy math. that's where their specialty is at. But maybe they come on the team to do something else. So I think it's not really a geek team, mm-hmm. you know, or like a section of the school that's a geek. I think everybody has a little bit of geek in them somewhere.
And Genevieve, what about girls? I mean, this is we're talking about Legos and stuff like that. Is there more space for young women to be a part of this, or do you have to step out of sort of established, you know, cliques and groups to be a part of an inventing team?
Well, I think what's interesting is that I think there really is the people who have similar interests stay in certain groups, whatnot. So I think the cliques are still established. But I think it's very interesting. I'm noticing now, I'm sure everyone has experienced, like, geeks who are persecuted, or someone who's really athletic is not, or so on and so forth. But I find that now there's sort of a dynamic shift in society. In high school and lower, you know, levels of education, where people who maybe are different, maybe from, you know, kind of break the mold, are now the CEOs of companies, are now ruling the world, and that sort of persecution, that sort of, you know, hey, Four Eyes, is ending, and they're gaining more respect. I know I am, for, you know, being somewhat different.
James, how do you see it?
Her point is excellent. In the wake of the dot-com boom, there's been a renaissance in the geek in America, which is great. So
this is sort of a time to embrace your geekness rather than
I went to when I was coming up, I went to a normal high school. The social cliques were well established. Yeah. I was definitely not in the cool clique. And that's something that is a real problem. You actually made a comment. You apologized for talking technically about your family, Julia Genevieve. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's horrible. We need more technical talk in this country. We need more people who are talking about things that are technical. It needs to be socially acceptable to talk about electrostatic conductors on fan blades. If that's something you want to talk about.
It'll never happen again.
But I wonder if computers are taking us in that direction, because computers bring a new language to our sort of everyday discourse, and the verbs and the nouns that go with even the basics of operating a computer, whether it's email or working on the internet, these are now familiar. So it's the familiar language for all of us, and that takes us a little bit in the direction that you guys were talking about, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because you can look at somebody who's an extremely, what we would call, geek, you know, somebody who's extremely into technology and into all the latest new gadgets, or somebody who, you know, doesn't even have a computer at home. They just go to the library and use a computer, and yet they both still know what email is, and they both still, you know what LOL means, and you know, they. So that, I think the fact that computers are becoming more readily available to almost everyone, and the fact that everybody is becoming, as a society, everybody's becoming more comfortable with integrating computers into right. daily life, I think that's helping to blend the lines that used to be very apparent. Because, you know, if you look back when computers were only available to college students in very expensive colleges, if you try to get one of those people to talk about what a computer was to somebody else, they'd label them as a geek right there. But now that everybody kind of has a little bit of common ground to work with, it's getting to the point where it's not there yet, but it's getting to where people are not so cut out from the rest of everyone else just because they like computers or just because they like technology.
Let's go back to our callers. We're at 1-800-423-8255 to Paxton, Massachusetts. Nate's on the line. Nate, how are you?
Good. I just wanted to make a quick comment about talking about schools not teaching sort of these hands-on courses.
Yeah.
I'm a high school student, and this year I took a course on creating an electric vehicle. And that before, when I was taking this course, though, I was received some pressure not to, because parents were saying to me that colleges would not view it. And it also reminds me, too, how my school actually dropped woodworking for French. And I feel like a lot of schools now are getting pressure to drop these vocational-like classes in favor of more quote-unquote academic classes.
The people who were saying that the work on the electric car wouldn't look good on a college application, I don't understand that, Nate. I would have thought that would be something you'd put gold stars all around.
Well, people were saying, though, that colleges would just totally ignore the grade from that and would not count it as a class.
Not at all. So that's You know, at a place like MIT, when you're looking at the applications, I've never been in the admissions process, but from what I hear, people who apply usually have pretty good grades, and it's usually very difficult to distinguish them based on their academic performance. But when you show up and say, listen, I worked in a solar car, I designed the bipolar MOSFET driver thing that makes the car go. I did this thing. I learned that tire pressures need to be very high in the solar, blah 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 blah. That sets you on a different plane than your colleagues.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it was also too just interesting how my school dropped the woodworking French, and I got this feeling though that they just sort of these classes don't count as much as let's say French or history.
Well, I think you made the right decision, and schools are being squeezed from all sides with budgets, and they've had to make very, very hard decisions.
I think the reason some of the reason at least why schools are feeling like they need to drop the woodworking classes or the shop classes or the metal shop classes are because people the general public, the people that actually make the decisions and take them before the school board, are seeing technology move towards more computer oriented things.
So what do you need a lathe for? What do you need a press for?
Exactly. But what people aren't thinking about is the things that you don't see, like this or those robots. For the robots, you know, all you see is this thing that drives around with lots of circuitry on it, and you're like, wow, you know, that's a great computer. But you don't think about all the design that went into building that skirt for it or designing the mounts for that circuit board. That's what people don't see enough of, and I think that's why they're not putting more value on the shop classes or on the, you know, woodworking classes and things like that.
We need to take this show to the meeting of the school district. let's go to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and Norman's joining us. Hi there.
Hello.
Tell me what you're thinking.
Oh, I was thinking what we seem to be talking about is problem-solving abilities, and I know that there's a lack of problem-solving ability among young people in this country. I saw it in a study that was done, a couple of years ago, 15-year-olds, and
what did it show, Norman? I don't remember this study.
Well, it shows that the United States is well below the median, right above some third world countries in problem solving ability. In spite of the fact we spend per capita much more per student than some of the countries that were doing well in problem solving ability.
What do you attribute that to? Is it that?
This is purely speculation. I have no basis for knowing whether it's true or not, but it occurred to me that when I was a kid, there was a lot more free time that we had where we spent unsupervised by parents but potentially getting in trouble and having to solve problems on our own.
It's a really interesting point, and it's come up on this program before. Genevieve, this idea that you've got to go first to, you know, modern dance class and then to soccer practice, and then you have to go for your piano lesson, and then you do your homework, and then you go to bed. And like, where is the time for the Barbies? Where is the time for the Legos? Is Norman right to say kids really kind of need that free imagination time?
Well, I think it's important that you have that time, but it may not be that you're given that time. I find with my personal experience that I have to make time to do that, to find time to do something that I just need to kind of escape, the constraints of, okay, I need to pass this class, I need to, you know, meet this requirement so I can, you know, always looking ahead into the future but not thinking immediately, you know, I need to do this. And I think it is important that you either, if you don't have the time, that you should make the time if that time isn't offered to you to create something.
I think also the lack of problem-solving ability, this is my personal opinion also, much like the caller, I don't have any proof to validate this or back this up, but my opinion on that is that we aren't being faced with enough problems. I mean, now if you need to do something, you can usually, you know, Google for it, or you can look online and find the answer for it. But whereas people that don't have those types of resources readily available are more or less forced to create their own way to get around these problems. And I think that if you really want to challenge people and get rid of this lack of problem-solving ability, that you have to present them with more problems that they're forced to overcome.
We actually have a call from a parent in Boston. Joan is joining us. And Joan, I'm going to get you to direct this question to James.
Okay. Hi, James. This is Joan. I'm pretty much a single mother in Boston. I have a 13-year-old son, and he's interested in inventing. And they don't offer anything at his school that supports this interest. And I'm completely unable to do anything. And I don't know, how do I find camps or programs or something that I can provide for him?
Or does it have to be a camp? Does it have to be a program?
So my mother's very non-technical. I grew up with her. My parents are divorced. My father was a very important part of my life. He's an engineer by training. My mother is a speech therapist by training. So she was not able to really give me direct technical advice, but always able to provide for me all the resources and all the materials and everything that she could imagine that I could need. So, for example, what can you do for your son? You can make sure that the boxes are well-stocked with Lego. You can make sure that there's always tape in the tape dispensers. The screwdrivers are always available. Toys were the things that I worked on when I was young. I was always trying to build better toys. I was trying to have more fun with bicycles, more fun with radio-controlled cars.
See, we have this idea that when you're 13 or older, the toys are you're past the toys.
No. Toys are very, very important. I learned a lot of good engineering from the toys I had. Radio-controlled cars, in particular, are a wonderful thing at the age of 13. Not the ones from Radio Shack and Toys R Us, the hobby store variety. The ones that I can get up to 30, 40 miles an hour. Those are excellent electromechanical systems to learn on.
Also, if a toy breaks, I know a lot of the time, like, I have nephews, and if one of their toys breaks, if they smash it against the ground, it's thrown away. I think that's one of the most just horrifying things you can do.
Yes.
Is throw away a toy. If it's broken, your kid a hammer, a screwdriver,
right.
And some
Amen.
Tape, and sit him down on a table.
Amen.
So even if they break it by taking it apart, it's better than taking something without a wheel and putting it in the garbage?
Exactly.
Yeah, my funny story, going back to my brother, he used to have a Power Ranger doll. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that show. It was on a while ago. And actually, he used to play pretty aggressively with this toy. Both of his femurs, or his, like, the lower part from the knee down, broke off. And then he would continue to play. And then, over time, the arms fell off and so forth. And he continued to play and invent. So, it was pretty interesting.
It can happen. And I want to thank the three of you for coming in and joining me on the program. Andrew Ester, it was great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Genevieve Garris, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
James McLurkin, thanks a lot for
always
coming in.
Always a pleasure.
Andrew and Genevieve are part of the Lemelson MIT Invent Teams recipients, teams that won awards for their high school work. James McGurkin is a PhD candidate in computer science at MIT. You can find him most times at the Computer Science Artificial Intelligence Lab. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.